Good day. All sites are now online in the listen-only mode. At this time, it's my pleasure to hand off the conference to your moderator, Joel Finkelstein. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you for joining us today. Lester Brown has been called by the Washington Post one of the world's most influential thinkers, an environmental analyst and author. He's the recipient of many prizes and awards, including more than 20 honorary degrees and an MacArthur Genius Fellowship. Today, he is the president of the Earth Policy Institute, and his recent book is Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. On this call, Lester will discuss the trends that are dramatically raising food prices and why business as usual is not a viable option. With that, Lester Brown.
Thanks, Joel. We are now looking at a food situation unlike any that we've seen before. In the past, over the past half century, we've seen surges in grain prices, but they've always been event-driven. A poor harvest in the Soviet Union in 1972, for example, or a monsoon failure in India at some point, or a crop withering heat wave in the Midwestern United States. But this current surge in grain and food prices is driven not by an event, but by trends. And I'll come back to that in a minute. What we're beginning to see with this record increase in grain and food prices, which is a worldwide phenomenon, is signs that the social order is breaking down in some places. In Thailand, for example, a fairly stable country as developing countries go, there's been an outbreak of rice rustling where people come in and harvest the rice in a ripe rice field during the night. And this is happening in five rice-growing provinces in Thailand. In Darfur, we see an extraordinarily difficult situation where the World Food Program, which is responsible for getting food into the 2 million refugees in the Darfur camps, has to bring the food in through Libya, can no longer bring it in through the Sudan from the east. During the last 3 months, 56 of their grain-laden trucks have been hijacked. They've recovered 20 of the trucks. 24 of the drivers are still unaccounted for. The food going to the camps has been roughly cut in half by this disruption, and it could lead to widespread starvation in the camps if we can't somehow restore the security of the trucks that are taking the food in. In Bangladesh, in the last few days, we've seen 10,000 textile workers striking, rioting, concerned because while the price of rice has doubled, their wages have not increased at all in recent months. And they're caught in an impossible situation. This situation is different in three important ways. One, as I mentioned, this is not an event-driven situation, because if it were event-driven, a poor harvest in a major food-producing country, then the challenge is to sort of make it to the next harvest, and countries can do that in various ways. It's a one-year thing. But this situation is trend-driven, and the trends are well-established trends, some of them gaining momentum, and all of them having a cumulative effect on the world food balance. So this is new. The second thing, and it derives from the first, is this is not a temporary situation. This is going to last for some time. How long, we don't know. How long will depend on what governments are able to do and how effectively we can mobilize to deal with the causes of the problem. The third thing is this current price surge affects more people than any in the past for two reasons. One, there are more people in the world, and two, it is affecting the entire world. For example, in 1972, when the Soviets had a poor harvest and secretly cornered the world's exportable supplies of wheat, and in the process managed to double world wheat, corn, and rice prices, China was not part of the market then. It was pretty well isolated. Today, China, indeed every country in the world, is pretty well integrated into the world food economy and is therefore affected by these rises in prices. The other thing that we need to keep in mind is that the poor are affected much more than the rich by these price rises. And there are two reasons for that. One is that in the industrial countries, there's so much processing in our food that it minimizes the effect of rising commodity costs on the final food product. For example, I buy a loaf of whole wheat bread in the local supermarket here in Washington, D.C. for $3. It has maybe 30 cents worth of wheat in it. If the price of wheat doubles, then the loaf of bread will cost not $3, but $3.30. Not a huge increase. But if you live in northern India or in Pakistan, for example, and you buy your wheat in the market as wheat, bring it home, grind it into flour, and make chapatis, when the price of wheat doubles, your price of food doubles. Or consider rice. There's almost no processing involved with rice. The rice in the market and the rice that's in the world market and the rice that one carries home from the market is essentially the same rice. The second thing is that the share of income spent for food varies widely between affluent countries and low-income countries. In the industrial countries, for example, roughly 10 to 20% of income is spent for food. In low-income countries, however, it can be easily 50 or 60% or more. So when the price of food doubles, a lot of people, and by a lot of people I mean hundreds of millions, many hundreds of millions are going to be caught in an almost impossible situation. Another thing we see when prices tighten, and this is not new, this has happened a number of times in the past, is that a politics of scarcity emerges. Exporting countries begin to restrict exports or even sometimes ban them in order to keep food prices down domestically. We've seen among the wheat exporters, we've seen Russia, Argentina, the Ukraine, all restricting exports. And then just overnight, we've heard that Kazakhstan is going to ban wheat exports. With rice, Vietnam, Cambodia, Egypt have all restricted rice exports. So this makes the world market even tighter than it would otherwise be. We've seen the emergence of bilateral agreements, again, for the first time in many, many years, where a country like the Philippines, for example, that imports rice will try to work out a special agreement with an exporting country, in this case Vietnam, to provide an assured amount of rice in the years ahead. One of the more novel approaches to trying to secure food supplies has come from Libya, a country that imports most of its grain, so it's highly vulnerable. Libya has worked with the government of the Ukraine to literally lease 100,000 hectares to grow grain that would be shipped to Libya. 100,000 hectares. 247,000 acres. So we're seeing various efforts made by countries to try and ensure the food imports that they need. I mentioned earlier that this current situation is trend-driven. It's systemic. On the demand side, we're still adding 70 million people a year, and we'll add, according to the projections, almost that many per year until mid-century. You don't have to be an agronomist to understand that if you keep adding 70 million people to a finite resource base, i.e. the Earth itself, you're eventually going to get into trouble. And a lot of countries are in trouble now on the food population front. The second trend, this is not new either, though it's become much more important in recent years, is that there are some 4 billion people in the world who want to move up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive meat, milk, eggs, etc. The third trend, and this is one that has literally exploded in the last few years, is the U.S. use of grain to produce ethanol. From 1990 through 2005, the growth in grain consumption was about 20 million tons a year. During the last 2 years, 2007 and now in 2008, it has jumped to about 50 million tons a year, the difference being roughly 30 million tons per year of additional grain being used to produce ethanol from the 2007 harvest and roughly the same amount from the 2008 harvest that we're beginning, will be underway later in the summer. So, stated otherwise, the growth in world demand for grain these last 2 years from U.S. ethanol distilleries exceeds the growth in world demand for grain from all other sources. It is a huge new factor in the world market, and it's one reason why farmers are struggling so much. On the supply side, we're losing a lot of cropland, particularly in major producing countries like the U.S., and China, and India, whether it's housing developments moving up the Central Valley in California or thousands of new factories being built in the Yangtze River Basin of China, it's taking a lot of prime cropland. So that's become an important new factor, an important new trend affecting the world supply-demand balance. Beyond cropland, beyond the loss of cropland, there's not much new cropland that we can bring under the plow unless we clear tropical rainforest in the Amazon and Congo basins or in Indonesia. The other option, of course, is clearing more land in the Brazilian Cerrado, which is the savanna-like area south of the Amazon basin. So cropland is becoming a key issue. World population continues to grow. The cropland area does not. With the second basic resource is water. World demand for grain is simply outrunning the water supply, which is why half the world's people now live in countries where water tables are falling. This is an issue that's largely below the radar. It's not discussed much in the thousands of articles that have been published on the tightening food situation in recent weeks and months. But water is one of the keys to future food security. Let me just mention what's happening very quickly in four countries. Yemen. 22 million people. Its grain harvest has declined by 60% over the last 25 years or so because it's losing irrigation water as its aquifer is depleted. On the other end of the scale, huge country, China. Its wheat is produced mostly in the northern half of the country where water tables are falling everywhere. China's wheat harvest has dropped from a historical peak in 1997 of 123 million tons to 106 million tons last year, a 15% drop, largely because of the loss of irrigation water. India, a World Bank study, has pointed out that 175 million Indians are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. You can overpump in the short run, but not, by definition, in the long run. And as the aquifers are depleted, we're likely going to see an actual decline in the grain harvest in India, a country that's adding 18 million people a year. Saudi Arabia. The Saudis announced in January that they are depleting their water resources. They've been pumping heavily from a fossil aquifer a half mile down. They plan to phase out all irrigated grain production in Saudi Arabia by 2016. They're going to reduce the crop by one-eighth each year over the next 8 years, and then they'll be importing all of their grain. These are just some examples of how water is affecting world food production. but it's going to be a major factor in trying to work our way out of this current very tight situation. And the third factor after land and water is technology. The backlog of unused water technology, of agricultural technology, is dwindling. From 1950 to 1990, world farmers raised grain yields by 2.1% per year. From 1990 to 2007, this has dropped down to 1.2% per year. We tend to turn to genetically modified crops as the answer to this, but the basic reality is that there are no genetically modified crops that have been developed over the last 20 years that we've been releasing new crops that will have much effect on yield. They've been very good at other things, at developing insect-resistant varieties, for example, so we can eliminate the use of insecticides, but we don't have any dramatic advances in yields, nor are we likely to get any, simply because we're already pressing against the limits of plant physiology. In 7 of the last 8 years, world grain consumption has exceeded production. This means we've been drawing down stocks in 7 of these 8 years. We're now down to 55 days of consumption. This is carryover stocks. How much grain you have in the bin when the new harvest begins? That's the lowest on record. We are one poor harvest away from chaos in world grain markets. In the past, when things have tightened, farmers who responded to higher prices and expanded production, but in many parts of the world now, doing that simply means more overpumping or plowing more marginal land. It's interesting that the commodities market is now beginning to recognize this. If you look at wheat or corn futures prices, for example, for November and December, they are higher than they are for, say, May or July, which means the market expects this tight situation to continue even after the next harvest. What do we need to do? The most important thing we can do in the short run to restore some semblance of stability to the world grain markets and to the world food economy is to reduce the amount of grain going into fuel for cars in the United States. And that's something the U.S. government has to do. I've noted that the government has announced that it will provide $200 million for emergency food assistance. $200 million will buy enough rice to keep 1 million people fed for a year. This is literally a drop in the bucket. We're looking at a situation where hundreds of millions of people are trapped between rising food costs and more or less fixed wages. This is the issue that has to be dealt with, and it means we have to deal with the causes. I mentioned reducing the amount of grain going to fuel for cars in the U.S. The second is we've got to stabilize populations sooner rather than later, and that means attacking the poverty issue, as well as providing reproductive health care and family planning services. The third thing we need to do, and this needs to be a worldwide effort, is to raise water productivity. We need an initiative like the one that was launched a half century or so ago to raise world land productivity when we realize we're facing enormous projected growth in population but not much new land to bring under the plow. As a result of that initiative, we have nearly tripled world grain yield per acre since 1950. It's been a remarkable achievement. We now need to do something approaching that with water. In this current situation, we have hundreds of millions of people trapped, and they're trapped between rising food costs and low wages, and they're becoming desperate. Bob Zelig, president of the World Bank, reported a couple of days ago that we've now seen the first government fall as a result of this food situation, and that was the dismissal of Prime Minister Jacques-Edouard Alexis in Haiti because the Senate in Haiti felt he had not adequately addressed this issue. This situation is a systemic one where we have to alter basic trends, in some cases reverse those trends. And that's going to be difficult. That's what makes this current situation so different from those in the past. We're seeing spreading social unrest and political instability in scores of countries in the world. The list of failing states, which was already getting longer year by year, is likely to increase dramatically as governments face potentially unmanageable food shortages. And then the question becomes, how many failing states before civilization itself begins to unravel? I see the current situation not as just a food shortage, but as a situation that is chronic in nature, and where we're just on the edge of it now, where it's going to get far worse in the months and quite possibly the years ahead. And the risk is that it could lead to an unraveling of civilization itself as more and more countries turn inward and try to deal with their problems internally and particularly the exporting countries. This could create a degree of instability in the world that we simply have not seen in peacetime before. That's the nature of this challenge, and I don't think that the world, and certainly Washington, has yet quite realized the dimensions and the seriousness of the problem that we're facing. Joel?
Thank you so much, Bud, sir. That was a question.
Very well. Our first question comes to us from Jeffrey Lean from The Independent. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hi there, son.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi. Let's just try, it's a small part. I very much take what you say, but a small part. You talked about GM not getting us anywhere because they're bumping up against the limits of plant physiology. Could you explain that in more detail?
Mm-hmm. during the 60s and 70s, we saw, beginning in the 50s, we saw some dramatic rises in grain yields around the world. With corn, it was the result of hybridization. In the U.S., with wheat and rice, it was the dwarfing of those that originally took place in Japan. But the dwarfing of the wheat and rice varieties meant that more of the plants photosynthate, or less of the plants photosynthate, was needed to produce straw, because the plants were much shorter. And so that could then go into the formation of seeds. But once you've done those things, those sort of easy, dramatic increases, and that did help to double wheat and rice yields. Once you've done that, then the physiological limits are there. I mean, I think of it a little bit in terms of running. I mean, we ran a 6-minute mile before the first modern Olympics, and in Athens in 1896, I think someone ran well under 5 minutes. Then Roger Bannister ran a 4-minute mile in 1954. But we don't even talk about a 3-minute mile today. Because I mean, despite the advances in training techniques and sports psychology and so forth, we're approaching a point where it's very difficult to get even very small gains. And the same thing is happening with crop yields. I mean, plants have their physiological limits in the same way that distance runners do.
Right.
Next question?
Yes, our next question comes from R.J. Smith from The Humanist. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was just wondering, does your criticism of ethanol extend to other biofuels, such as biodiesels? I'm asking in particular about biodiesels made from non-crop resources, such as lab-grown algae, wild sawgrass, and bio-waste, including used oils from fast food restaurants.
Used oils from fast food restaurants make great diesel fuel. I mean, once it's filtered and cleaned, that's fine. The problem is it's so minute compared with the overall level of biodiesel use, but that's a good idea. The key to making biofuels more competitive and sustainable is developing an economic technology to convert cellulosic material, switchgrass, for example, into fuel for cars. But that's years and years away. We're not even close to doing that yet. And meanwhile, we continue converting more and more grain into fuel for cars. From the 2007 harvest, we're converting 18% of that into fuel for cars. For this year's harvest, it looks like it'll be about 28%. And so we've got to deal with the short-term issue now, even while we're waiting and hoping that a cost-competitive technology will be developed for converting cellulose into fuel for cars.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is star one to queue up for a question. All right, our next question comes to us from Martin Dowdite from DeWelt. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. I'm with the German Daily DeWelt. I have a question about export restrictions. A couple of countries have announced export restrictions over the last couple of months. And I was wondering, to which extent do you think that has worsened the price situation?
Well, it has both an economic effect in reducing the amount of grain available for importing countries. I'm thinking particularly of, say, Russia and Argentina, which are important wheat exporters. I think both are in the top five now. And so that obviously affects the world market supply-demand balance, and it tightens it. The other thing is the psychological effect of importing countries knowing that exporting countries will do this, and in fact are doing this, makes them feel very insecure about the future. And that's why you see governments like Libya that imports most of its grain wanting to tie down some cropland in the Ukraine, for example, or the Philippines trying to get Vietnam to agree to a multi-year commitment of rice. So it has, I think it clearly is having an effect both economic and psychological. As I recall, some days ago, maybe a week or two ago now, when Egypt announced that it was going to ban the export of rice because wheat prices had gone up so fast within the country, and they were having fights breaking out in bread lines and so forth because there just wasn't enough to go around. When that happened, the price of rice in Asia reportedly went up 30% in just a few days because it was kind of the tipping point on that issue. I mean, rice was already pretty high, but it just took another big jump in a matter of days. And that's the risk here of not knowing when exporting countries will restrict and how severely, whether it'll be a total ban or a partial ban or what have you. So it has both an economic and a psychological effect on the market. Thank you.
Next question. Thank you. We next go to the site of Andy Mantle from Markwire.org. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Lester.
Hi.
I had a question about raising water productivity. You mentioned that we were able to raise land productivity, and I wonder what suggestions you have for being able to raise the water productivity of our agriculture.
When I talk about water productivity, I'm not thinking only about agriculture, though that is obviously of overwhelming importance because 70% of all the water we use in the world is for irrigation. With irrigation, we have a number of options. The most inefficient is flood irrigation. The most efficient is drip irrigation, in between this overhead sprinkler irrigation. The drip irrigation is at least twice as efficient as most other forms of irrigation because it's a very controlled supply. There's not much evaporation in the atmosphere, and the water reaches the root system where the plants need it in a very gradual, controlled sort of fashion. So there are possibilities with irrigation. Another possibility with irrigation is simply to shift to more water-efficient crops. For example, Egypt grows rice for export, but rice is a highly water-intensive crop, one of the most water-intensive, and it might be much better in terms of the amount of grain produced if Egypt were to switch that rice land to the production of wheat, where the yield would be higher and the water use would be far less. So you might get, per unit of water used, you might get a doubling of the amount of grain produced, for example. So there are those kinds of things that can be done. Other things that can be done are with the industrial use of water in cities. There are some corporations now that use water in their processing that have devised water recycling systems where they use very little new water. They just keep using the same water over and over again. That's entirely possible from a technological point of view, and it's becoming increasingly feasible from an economic point of view, given rising water costs and spreading water shortages. Another thing that can be done is for cities to recycle water. I mean, we have now a rather, in engineering terms, primitive system, water system in the world's cities. It's a system where water comes in one side of the city, relatively clean and potable and usable, is used once and leaves the city polluted and a problem. One of the responses to this, sort of the flush and forget system, if you will, is the replacement of water flush toilets with the dry, odorless compost toilets. And we're seeing this happen in some of the LEED certified buildings in the United States. We're seeing some colleges and universities install these composting toilets. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation, in its, I think it has a platinum LEED certified rating, use compost toilets. There are probably 100,000 in use now in northern China, where water's in very short supply. So this is a technology that is available and on the market, but we've not yet incorporated it into the system in a major way, one that would save an enormous amount of water. So these are some of the things that can be done to begin to reduce water use in both agriculture and also in urban and industrial uses as well.
Thanks. Next question.
Thank you. And our next question comes to us from Hyder Rizvi from One World Yahoo.
Hi, Dr. Lester.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for inviting us. I'm just wondering if you could say something about the consumption patterns in the industrialized world and how much food is wasted in the United States and many other industrialized countries.
Well, there are sort of two dimensions to that question, as I said.
And if it has something to do with the subject that you have been talking about.
Right. One is the amount of sheer wastage of food, the amount of food that ends up in the garbage here, and it occurs at both the household level, but is sort of most obviously at the restaurant level, where so many restaurants provide jumbo portions that many people can't eat or wouldn't want to eat because it's just too much food, and so I think we need to begin rethinking restaurant marketing and begin to have more variations in portion size. And some restaurants do this now. They have a smaller and a larger choice of sizes. So that's one thing to do. The other thing to do is to move down the food chain in industrial societies. And certainly in a country like this one or in Canada, for example, we live very high on the food chain. And the difference between the amount of grain required for the average diet in India and the average diet in the United States is the difference between, in round numbers, 200 kilograms a year per person in India and 800 kilograms of grain per person in the United States. We could move down the food chain and substantially and have healthier diets and use a lot less grain. In fact, one of the recommendations I've made in the past, but I didn't mention it just now, is if we're faced with a really tight world food situation, one way of freeing up grain for human consumption would be to tax, to have a meat tax, for example, in affluent societies.
Thanks very much. Next question.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question is from Hader Rizvi again.
Dr. Lester, looking at your the recommendations, the question comes to mind if the policymakers in Washington and other capitals of G8 countries and the rest of the world, do you see any signs of serious political will to consider what you and many like-minded researchers like you are suggesting?
No. Not only is the political will not there yet, I'm not sure that there's an understanding of what's happening. I think here in official Washington that the feelings is that this is another one of those surges in world prices, you know, that's in world grain prices that's happened, you know, from time to time in the past, and we just need to sort of ride it out, and then things will come back to normal. But this is not an event-driven rise in prices. This is a systemic problem. It's the result of the cumulative effect of several different trends, which I've mentioned briefly, and unless we can mobilize worldwide to eradicate poverty and stabilize population, unless we can mobilize worldwide to reduce, and this is particularly for the U.S., to reduce the amount of grain going to ethanol, unless we can mount a worldwide effort to raise water productivity, there may not be a humane solution to this situation we're in now. That's what concerns me. I don't think the world has yet sort of grasped this. There's still a, you know, knowing we're in some sort of trouble, but thinking it's like, you know, the situations we've faced in the past. It's not. It's fundamentally different, and that's why we're doing this Plan B update and this teleconference right now.
Thank you so much for your response.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Well, thank you very much. Lester and Tom, with that, I'd like to end the call. I'd like to say that anyone who's interested in more background on any of the issues raised today or speaking further with Lester Brown can contact me, Joel Finkelstein. My phone number is 202-822-5200, extension 279. And my email is Joel, J-O-E-L, @Fenton.com. Thank you very much.
And let me say thanks to everyone for participating.